Hey, everybody. I just wanted to take a moment to apologize up front. Unfortunately, we were having some problems with Skype this week, and it did affect the recording of the show. Now, I was able to save a lot of the audio quality, but their timing can be a little bit off at times. So if you hear something that's not quite right, just imagine that's when the temporal dampers failed and we started kicking the console, and everything's okay now. Enjoy the show and our discussion of Children of Earth Day 5. Welcome to episode 54 of Gallifrey Public Radio. It's been a long, grueling road, but we have finally made it to discuss Day 5 of Children of Earth. But first, your host. I'm Jay Whitten.
Are we talking adult like Torchwood or adult like Cinemax after 11 p.m.?
And with me are Melissa Mazza.
I demand to be referred to as Sagacity from now on.
And Keir Hansen.
The jockstrap of Rassilon is formidable and large.
Spoilers.
We will be discussing news and rumors, as well as episodes that have already aired. But if we get into anything too serious, don't worry. We'll warn you again.
Welcome to episode 54 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where we how the hell would we just sit here and watch and go numb. It is the last day, day 5 of our Children of Earth walk, and we have been to hell and back, and then back to hell, and then back, and then we realized we left our iPod there, so we went back to hell and came back one more time. But better for the experience, in my opinion. So, my name is Kier, and joining me here in the GPR studios, as always, is Jay. How are you, sir?
Doing all right.
Okay, all things considered.
Well, yeah. Sorry, force of habit.
And Melissa, how are you, dear?
I'm good. How are you?
Excellent. Well, we have run the gauntlet. I don't know how many times you guys can admit to having watched this miniseries.
Too damn many.
Yeah. But, you know, again, like all good writing, you pick up something new every time. And because of the fact that we were putting this under such a microscope, I kind of think we did too. So we can kind of dive right into it here. Obviously, when last we met our fair heroes, we had gotten our good solid glimpse of the 456. We found that the children that were taken back in the 1960s were still with them and had not aged and aren't looking so great. And all of the children of the world are chanting out the numeric equivalent of 10% of their population within each country where they're being heard. So, and Lois has stepped up and has become the...
Stepped up in a big way.
Yeah. So she's helping with the, I don't know if you could call it blackmail. I guess you could call it the...
manipulation.
Yeah.
Call it extortion. That. The X makes it sound cool.
Okay, fair enough. So let's dive into this. The first thing that we have in the notes here is one of the first things that we see and is probably, in my opinion, one of the biggest gut punches.
Oh, definitely.
That this series hands out, and that's Gwen's video recording. And her very specific mention.
Yeah, so this is where this is where they give fan service of people who are saying, where the hell is the doctor in all this? So we finally have Gwen saying, where the hell is the doctor?
I wouldn't even call it fan service. It's more just the... I think it just drives home the point of how dire the situation is.
But I mean, honestly, if they hadn't mentioned him, I wouldn't even be thinking of the doctor.
Yeah, that's why I'm saying I don't think that it's fan service. I don't think it's people that were sitting there waiting to hear his name or see him come in and save the day or something. It was just like, hey, let's bring up the doctor just to prove how bad off things are.
Right, because as she phrases, as she expresses it, it's a matter of, you know, even he can look at these things and turn his face away. That's brutal.
Yeah.
I mean, that you talk about your you know, your religious subtext and your allegory there and saying that, you know, this near God amongst us, you know, finds certain actions on our part so deplorable that even he washes his hands of it. That's okay. Then we're 25 seconds into this episode, and I already feel like I've had my guts twisted in a knot.
Yeah, I remember the first time I watched this, was sitting there, and I blew through it all. You know, I couldn't stop watching. So I'd just come off day 4, just watched Ianto die, just watched all of that horrible stuff that we just went through, and then it starts off Gwen saying, you know, how did she phrase it? You know, I've always wanted to ask Jack about his doctor. And I was like, oh, they're mentioning the doctor. Things are going to get better from this point. And then she says that, and I'm like, oh, no, they're not. It definitely sets the tone for this episode.
Without question. And this is where some of the earlier episodes kind of followed a typical kind of a sci-fi curve, or another one followed a sort of a government, double cross curve, or an espionage curve. This one is strictly dark drama at this point. And it doesn't let up, in my opinion. It doesn't really let up through the whole damn thing. So do we want to go through this one sort of step by step, or do we want to, save ourselves the torment and kind of go at it high level and just hit some of the points that we thought were poignant?
I don't know. I think everything that we've got in the notes here is kind of poignant.
Well, we mentioned in the previous episode, one of the things that we thought was particularly impactful was the fact that the government organizations were referring to children as units and using a lot of very specific double speak to try and keep this systematic and to go at it with very little emotion. But we come to a realization that the reason for these units is something far more horrid. When the unit rep outright asks the 4, 5, 6 why the children have been utilized all this time and why they're back for so many more of them.
I heard episode 54 of God.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Jay, you were mentioning that it was kind of, our discussion points here that we've laid out are going to allow us to kind of keep a safe buffer between ourselves and walking through every scene that we were subjected to here. But it's important to note that just as the unit and all the government representatives that were discussing the 4, 5, 6 and talking to the 4, 5, 6 through Frobisher or directly were using all of this great obscured and obfuscated doublespeak to try and keep things very systematic and methodical.
Right, referring to
as soon as they all hear right, as soon as they hear what the children are really being used for, this all starts to fall apart internally. Among those groups.
What struck me the most is when the Prime Minister, his face completely changes when he says, when he realizes it. And it's like, that's hilarious. Like, he's more upset. So basically the 4, 5, 6 are using the kids as drugs. And they say they need them for the hit and this chemical or whatever. And the Prime Minister, like, his face completely falls and he's upset. He goes, "We're trading in drugs?" Instead of, like, nothing about, like, killing little kids face him at all up until now. And then, like, he just completely changes at that moment.
We turn a corner as far as the reaction of some of our characters. Some of the characters that up to this point had just been very stoic and unflappable, among our unit representatives, our prime minister, and so forth. And they all seem to be handling this very, very officially and very coldly until the news comes forward that we find out that they're being used as a drug source.
Right.
Children are being used as a drug source, some chemical extraction from them.
I want to know, I'm well aware of how violently this hit me on a personal level. How did you guys react when you first realized what was going on?
Okay, well, can I just say before, when you guys couldn't understand me, this is what I was talking about, that the Prime Minister's face here, when he realizes it, he's more upset in the moment he goes, "We're trading in drugs," than he ever was about giving the kids to the 4, 5, 6.
Yeah, that was probably part of his campaign platform. His drug platform. Personally,
For me, I was just going to say, it didn't hit me that hard. I was like, oh, like, that's messed up. Like, number 99 in the messed up things in this episode.
Yeah, this was almost telegraphed for me personally. I kind of saw this train coming. But I think what was more effective, even if I had kind of determined that the fact that children were being harvested for something or they ensured that they weren't being harmed or they felt no pain or what have you, I think the combination of the fact that their lives were being stunted, that their growth was being stunted, and they were cognizant of what was going on while this was happening, combining that with, again, like we talked about last week, the way the 4, 5, 6 communicates and how stunted and expressionless they are when they describe, through the translator and how they describe these things.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was so, so creepy to hear them say the drugs.
I think what it was that got me was I was holding out for that, you know, that last bit of hope on that, you know, it's like, oh, well, what do you need them for? Oh, well, they help, you know, maintain our race. We're dying out and we're able to use a chemical that they've created to, you know, keep us fertile or keep our race going or something like, we use them as pot. It's just, it was that final nail in the coffin. Like, oh my God, there's nothing remotely redeemable about this situation.
Right.
And I think that's what it was just that, you know, not only is this such a horrible situation for, you know, the humans to be put into and for the government for what they're doing and everything like that, but even on the base level of why they want the kids, it's not even remotely good.
Yeah.
And it was just such a punch in the gut because I was just holding out for that one last bit of maybe there's something that can, you know, make this just a little bit of a salve on it. And there, you don't even get that.
No. In fact, I don't think they could have come up with anything that would have been more selfish or or completely I can't even find an accurate word for it that makes them decide, or they've gotten a taste of something, you know, how they even came to the realization back on their original visit.
I think the only thing they could have done that would have made this worse is, you know, oh no, we use them as sex slaves. Like, that's the only thing I could think of that would make it worse.
True.
And even then, it's just, it's kind of like, six and one half of the dozen. Yeah. It's like, no.
But it's so interesting. You take your usual kind of substance and pusher arrangement. This has been totally turned around because this is now like someone going to the dealer after your first, you know, free sample kind of thing. And instead of coming back and starting to pay up, they're showing up with an arsenal and saying, we'll take everything you have, please. So it's not even, it doesn't even put the supplier in a power position, so to speak. So that whole model's thrown out the window.
It's just a mess from the get-go. That's the problem.
Now, let's make this episode even more hard to watch.
Oh, God. Yeah.
And our friend, Peter Capaldi, gets to play a phenomenal dramatic sequence, not only in his incredulous reaction and discussion with the Prime Minister, where they have to go into this conversation about the fact that he's being set up as this. Thank you so much for one of our listeners who called him set up as a Patsy. Thank you. Patsy was a term that came up last week. And being told that his own children will be intentionally selected so that the government will look as
blameless and innocent.
Exactly. We're subject to the same trials and tribulations that you, the little unwashed masses, are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Frobisher at this point, you know, starts to lose it. And he's like, I'll expose what's going on. I'll tell them what's going on. And the Prime Minister is just like, why? Then your kids would know what their fate is. He's like, even if you said that, I'd still be sending your kids. And
I think that's it. That's the point. No matter what he does, the kids are goners.
And then this whole scene, just every time I can't help but cry. The, you know, Frobisher goes and tells Miss Spears that he needs a requisition order for something. I can't remember what code he used, but she's like, what do you mean? And he's like, no, I just need this. Go get it for me now. And you realize that he has requested a gun, and he goes home and tells his children and his wife to go upstairs into their room, and he follows them up. You see the door shut, and you hear three shots in quick succession, and then one final one.
Yep.
And it is just chilling. I mean, I've made no bones about how I feel about violence towards children. You know, this is one of my, you know, this is on my taboo list. It can't be done. And recently I had someone close to my family, their daughter had committed suicide, and I got a lot of the, you know, just everything that happened, even though it was, you know, three rings removed or whatever, how it still affected my family. And then in the within 24 hours, I had someone else very close to my family attempt suicide, actually pulled the trigger, and the gun didn't go off. This is all violence against kids and then suicide and things like this. It all very fresh in my mind and all very something that I cannot tolerate. And yet I look at this scene and I think, were I in Frobisher's shoes, I can't see myself responding any other way. And I think that is what makes the scene so powerful.
Wow. I hadn't even thought to look at it through that lens.
I remember during the family annihilation is what this is called, and during the downturn of the economy, you started to see a lot of these in the news. And I remember what the experts, quote unquote, were always saying was that this is like a very narcissistic thing. Like it takes a very specific personality type to do this because they usually lose their job and they're the provider for their family. And so they think like their family can't, it completely depends on them, you know, and they overestimate how much their family depends on them. So that's why they wipe them out. And John Frobisher does not strike me as fitting that mold. Obviously, you know. So it's interesting that you say, like, I can't imagine, you know, anyone not doing that. But
well, it's this is a lot different than, you know, my kids will have to go on welfare. You know, it's not something where, you know, there are other alternatives and the person is just too pigheaded to see it. This is a case of there is no way out. You know, it's at this point, there's no hope for redemption. They've got this plan in order and he's just been given the death sentence for his kids. You know, it's they're going to go. There's nothing you can do to stop it. You know, and I mean, he tried to fight it and was told you can't stop this. It's going to happen. And at that point, knowing what he does, you know, having seen everything that's come, you know, it's I can let them suffer through that or I can end it very quickly for all of us. You know, and I don't know. I think that it's a very different situation than, oh, I lost my job. Let me kill my whole family to, you know, so I don't look like an ass.
Right. This is almost along the lines of trying to take the family out of harm's way before the Holocaust. You know, that sort of an approach. Well, it's at this stage. And I'm not sure what timestamp you're at into the episode when this scene happens. You know, it's if you call it a five act episode, you're probably at the end of about the second act here. But everything really, it does not let up from here.
No, it really doesn't.
We have both on the emotional level and then all of a sudden the energy level and things that start to compound with that just make it even more intense, you know, building this fury, as we go on. Cause we've got the fact that Lois has a good discussion with Miss Spears and is able to kind of make her understand as a result of, you know, Frobisher's demise and those things, the fact that she is not that Lois is not alone in not wanting to just succumb to the company line, so to speak, on this. And she, Spears, decides to get involved as well.
And I think that was this is what justifies Lois for me in this whole series, is when Spears goes in to talk to her. And you know, the whole time we're seeing Frobisher do his thing, you know, we hear Spears describing him to Lois, saying, you know, he was a dedicated father. He was a good man. And, you know, the exact quote is, John Frobisher was a good man, and it wasn't his fault, nor will history remember him this way. And I think it's that moment where you have a character who's established that Spears can easily access. And yes, you could get around this easily, but it justified Lois for me in this scene where, you know, you have someone who's been there through it and Spears has gotten to know somewhat and would be okay opening up to her in this aspect. You know, if it were just someone, you know, some random person that we hadn't seen yet, I wouldn't buy it from Spears describing John Frobisher to him just to get it off her chest. Yeah, that's not really how it would get to me.
No, I accept that absolutely. And like I said, it took me a little while to come around to Lois. I didn't really understand the placement of her character, but because of the fact that she serves as the counterpoint to this, I can accept that. But okay, so they have their conversation. And they find they're going to have an opportunity to be able to further the cause, the rebellion, so to speak, as best they can. And Spears taking on Lois's role of being the eye in the sky, so to speak. And we get to some great again back to just characters that I came to absolutely love as a result of this season. And that was Yanto's extended family here. The scenes of them, you know, tucking children under their arms and running off in slow motion from guards and riot gear and rifles and whatnot. I mean, you talk about all the imagery that this episode in particular throws at you and forces you to look at for a long, long time.
Yeah. You know, and Andy, you know, whipping off his cop hat and his jacket and going at it with the soldiers. Yeah, just
I love that.
I mean, knowing you didn't start jumping up and down on the couch right there.
Oh yeah.
Shut up, Andy!
that's one thing this series does. You know, it has it in spades, is character development. You know, you come to such a strong emotional bond with so many of these characters. Some of them great, some of them not so much. But every one of the characters you're introduced to, you can't help but have an emotional feeling towards.
Right. Yeah. And even Andy, who up to this point through the previous seasons had always been almost a form of comic relief just because he was the sad sack that kept getting kind of pissed on by, you know, his you know, unrequited emotions for Gwen and his general dislike of Reese and just the fact that he was doing his best to try and raise the ranks, and do well within the service as well. But it was always kind of always being seen just as a traffic guard, a glorified traffic guard and things. And when you get this moment from him where he suddenly decides to break loose, it was just, granted, talk about the 11th hour all of this is happening, but it was a nice little gift for those of us who've known the character all along.
I also have in my notes for these scenes that if this were America, there'd be a lot more, like, gunfighting.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, those shots would have already been fired all over everyone's heads and tear gas flying and whatnot. A little more restrained, but still...
It's still chilling, yeah. It's still, like, this is, like, a terrifying thing.
Yeah.
The riot gear and bricks throwing and
Then we get to our cinematic full circle so that as they dash into the sort of darkened and uniquely shadowed warehouse that they start hiding out with the children, telling them that we're all going to play a game.
We've just been chased down by a bunch of soldiers, and you're telling us we're playing hide-and-seek? Yeah. I'm buying that.
As my parents would like to call in the car, this was the see who can shut up the longest while we finish this drive game. So I was never very good at it. And we get back to the moment where Gwen is making the tape. And it allows, as the taping ends, we get, just to add something a little bit more on top of this, we get into the discussion now of Gwen's pregnancy and Reese concerned that she would want to give up the baby in light of everything that's happening. You know, the kind of why, how can you bring a child into this world sort of a discussion.
Yeah. I don't know. I feel like at this point, you know, that's one of those things, like, you really want to talk about bringing a kid into this world now. Like, of all the times to try and get her to recant her statement on, you know, not wanting it anymore, you're going to pick now when you guys just got done running from soldiers who are trying to take these children away from you? Like, yeah, if you're looking for your moment, this is not it, buddy.
Yeah. But I think that speaks to Reese's mindset. And it's not a matter of selfishness and him saying, well, what is all this going to impact on me? But in everything that is going on around him and all the threats to everyone's lives and safety and well-being and futures and so forth, the one thing that is paramount in his head is this child that he and Gwen are creating, this life that they're creating, and his concern for his family, which is now a slightly larger family. And that will not leave his mind, despite the fact that there are, you know, guards chasing them down and they're bunkering in a warehouse and all these horrible things going on. And the full realization of the fact that everything he's been exposed to now that he's becoming an intrinsic part of Torchwood's, you know, carrying out their agendas and things. But all he's focused on and all that keeps coming up in his head anytime he's got 30 seconds of quiet to be able to get Gwen's attention is, tell me about this baby. That's Reese in a nutshell.
Yeah.
Well, and you were saying about character development, and like, talk about Reese. Like, you know, we love him by the end of this. And again, like, he's always with the baby. I'm reminded of the end of the episode when he's talking about how gorgeous Gwen is. Like, he's always thinking about them. Mm-hmm. So, he got a lot of character development over the series of Torchwood.
Yeah.
But
He definitely got the Rory treatment during this.
But yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Well, think where he started. He was just a rugby thug.
Yeah.
Essentially, and he was just kind of the lovable oaf, but he was treated very shallowly in terms of his write-up for the first series or so. And really, I think they gave him more material to work with. They gave the actor more material to work with, and he just devoured it, you know, and he became just a phenomenal character. I absolutely adore the guy. But I think that clear indication of the fact that, you know, as bullets are flying and smoke is swirling and so forth, and he's asking about, you know, her decision to have an abortion is something that is so stark in its contrast and so jarring in the fact that, you know, this is what you want to talk about right now, these things, is what really gets her attention and leads her to make the agreement. You know, she sees that it would, that with everything else going on, this is what's going to hurt him most. And that's what sways her.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. So then we go back to Jack, and he's in the bunker with Johnson and his daughter and grandchild, and they're trying to come up with some way to do it, and it's Decker, the dickhead who, you know, none of us can stand, who helps him come up with the solution of using the sound that they used to kill Clem back against them, feeding it through all the children, basically using their own broadcast system against them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they realize, well, we need a focal point for this. We need somewhere to start it from, but, you know, it's not going to end well for them. And Jack's like, yeah, well, even if we can't accomplish that, we don't have a kid. And Decker points out, yeah, we do. And that's when things really start to go downhill.
Yeah. How long does Jack really ponder this?
Not long enough.
Yeah.
It's one of those things, you know, it's look what's in the scales. You know, there's no way that this is even remotely balanced. So, you know, if you're looking at it completely rationally, then yes, it's going to be an easy decision. But how can you use the life of your grandson in a rational scenario? I don't get that. You know,
this whole episode is about such hard choices.
Well, there's hard choices, and then there's, you know, morbid choices. Even just the selection of, even if there was no family relation there, if there was one child that was, you know, some receptionist's daughter that had gotten caught in the chaos and she happened to be at hand, even that should have been a difficult decision for anyone to say, you know, okay, if you're going to be the source and all the other children are going to be the amplifiers, okay, even that alone. But perhaps this has quite a bit to do with, obviously, Jack's path up to this point. All the horrors that he has seen and caused and lived through, and just his understanding of seeing things on a far larger scale, that somewhere in there, you know, he tipped those scales.
Yeah, it's like you almost get to the point where it's like, as long as it's done, as long as this is over. Because, you know, yes, this has been a brutal 5 days for us. This has been 40 years in the making for Jack. So, you know, this really is his ultimate hero move here, but it doesn't make it less of a dick move.
No, it doesn't. You can clearly see the impact that it has on him, but there's a weariness to it as well, I think, in the way that Barrowman portrayed this scene in particular. And the fact that he's obviously carrying the full weight of this decision, and it's amplified, no pun intended, by the screaming that his daughter is doing, that Alice is just absolutely, I can't even come up with an accurate term for there are certain actresses or actors in general who are able to convey that point of absolute anger and panic, you know, that whatever emotion exemplifies or encompasses the two of them, where there's that moment of helplessness where you know that your child or your loved one is at such great risk. And while you want to do anything that you can to cease that or to halt that, and the sheer injustice of it all is weighing down on you, you can't let go of it. Even though you know that there's nothing you can do about it, you can't stay silent. And it just comes out as this absolute primal scream that she just rails and rails and rails, and it cuts the legs out from under her. And that is just as powerful to me personally as watching this look of numbness that drops over Jack's face, you know, as his tears are falling, knowing what he had to do, but something about the fact that he has, you know, this vast amount of time that he's seen all of these horrible things. It's almost as if he's conveying that he is fully aware of how horrid this decision is. He also has to be the one to take on the blame for it, because no one else possibly could.
Yeah, see, that hit me differently, because my whole thought through this scene was, like, Jack just portraying that numbness that comes after such a horrible thing, but with Alice, I was just like, she's taking this way too easily.
Yeah, she fought, like, for token fighting, and then, like you said, Kier, primal scream, which I agree, they juxtapose with Jack's calmness or whatever, but you're a mother, fight for your child. Yeah. Like, I would have, she should have, like, torn those doors down.
She stopped screaming and just sat and watched way too soon, at least from, in my opinion. But, you know, we know how I am.
Well, we make no assumptions as to how other parents will behave in a situation like that, that we'd ever have to face anything even remotely close.
Well, do you think there was also a sense of her knowing that this was the only way to do it too, and kind of giving in?
If that could even register, I don't know if something like that could even, you know, if a mother's mind could even process the fact that there could be any justification or explanation that would allow this to happen. If it reaches that level of it, it's completely unthinkable. And maybe the whole idea of the collapse and the going quiet or going slack and letting it happen was just a shutdown.
Yeah. I don't know. It just seemed like it happened too quickly for me, but I don't know. That's the great thing about this is it impacts people in so many different ways. Something that I brush off is vitally important to someone else, and everyone can get something out of this whole series. But that was just one thing that bothers me. It's right at the end. I'm like, if she had fought harder or screamed longer or something, she went quiet too quickly for you know, what I think should happen. And so it just kind of pulled me out of it at the last moment there. But
I think one of the main things about this episode or the whole four or five episodes in general is so much of like, what would you do? So, you know, in this situation, you might do something different, but everything is just so hard. Like, there is no one easy answer. Like, what choice did she really have?
Yeah.
And I wanted to, around this scene, to bring up something that the theme of the children in Children of Earth, like, you know, because we've just been talking about this viewpoint. I think if they had just asked him, this kid, Steven, probably would have allowed them to sacrifice him, like, knowing that he would save millions of children. But one of the themes of this is that children have no agency. Like, they're completely used in this, like, to the point where they actually are a drug. So, you know, I don't necessarily have an opinion about it, but I wanted to point out that this was, like, such a strong theme, and, like, this poor kid dies when, you know, it's all because the adults are making the decisions for him.
Not even knowing the nature of his sacrifice.
Right.
Yeah. Although, one thing I've heard John Barrowman talk about this, and he says that the kid, while they were getting ready to shoot the scene, he came up and asked John Barrowman, he's like, what can I do to make this creepier? And Barrowman told him, he's like, you know, just shake a little bit. And the kid's like, no, I can cry on cue. And he was like, do that and you will just destroy everyone. And he said when he saw the kid sitting there shaking and he saw that one tear start to come from his eye, he's like, oh, this is all over. Yeah. And I was like, how could you do that to people?
Well, this sets up a kind of a connection that brings us to, you know, we want an epilogue here. We want to know what the impact that this has had. Obviously, 4-5 is clear out of town. Government has been able to cover up the vast majority of the true nature of the secrets that they continue to maintain, probably with a large amount of units help on that regard. But we get our fast forward moment. I want to put something out here that's going to anger a fair number of Whovians, I think. But I'm willing to take this on because I think just based on this sequence alone, I think it's got a little bit of a justification. And that is that Jack Harkness is, on a certain level, a coward. I put that out there because of his reply and the fact that when situations have blown through and he's seen the destruction and he's one of the, obviously, you know, because of his abilities, typically one of the last ones standing, if not always the last one standing. When there are the repercussions and the guilt to be faced, he will run. And he says so.
Yeah. And that's the way that they wind up closing this out is Gwyn pleading with him, you know, you can't just run away from this, and him saying, can't I? And then, gone. It's like that sums Jack up in a nutshell right there. And
yeah, there's a point to this, you know, when they say, well, you know, why would he want to why would he just subject himself to dealing with who knows how long of all of the torment of the guilt and everything that's going on around him and having to face the faces of the survivors that know the true story and on. Well, He'll outlive it. They won't. You know, they might need his presence, or they might need him to be a bit of a punching bag for a while so that they can have some sort of healing or closure to this, particularly Alice, you know, but he'll run instead.
Mm-hmm.
And as much as we adore this character, and I still do, there are certain aspects of his persona that are intentionally written so that he is, at times, arrogant. We like the arrogance. At times, selfish. We love the selfishness. But there's times when he expresses cowardice as well, and this is one of them.
He's very human.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But also, this isn't the end of Jack Harkness, because we also see him in other canon material, namely Doctor Who. So I think he has a very good arc. So sometimes he's selfish, and sometimes he's not, and sometimes he's coward, and then he moves past that, you know, again, in a very human way.
So this
isn't the last we've seen of him.
I think that he's inherently selfish. He just has moments of clarity where he sees that he can help other people out. But I think underneath it all, there's always that, you know, how is this going to affect me in the long run? And he'll have his moments where he makes a sacrifice, but in the end, if you're immortal, how much are you really sacrificing? So, yeah, the way that one of the things I love about this series is that we go through all of this and we get to the end and they stop the bad guy. They save the world, but it's not a happy scenario. Like, they don't say, oh, okay, everything's fine, reset, we'll be back next week for, you know, happy-go-lucky fun time. It's they don't excuse the cost of what it took to win.
Right.
And one of the things that killed me, too, at the end, I forgot to put this in the notes, but when it's all said and done, when everything's finished, and Miss Spears is in the office with the Prime Minister and the other politician lady, and the Prime Minister's like, well, this all worked out better than it could have, you know, I could have expected. You know, this American general took it all on without sanction from the UN, so it's all going to fall on him, and I'm coming out of this clean. And I was like, seriously? Out of everything? And, you know, then Spears reveals that, you know, she was wearing Lois's contacts and that was all recorded and stuff. I was like, okay, now you're awesome. Now it makes sense. What she said earlier about, you know, John Frobisher would want me to be here for this. And the woman kind of blew it off like, I don't think anybody would want to be here for anything. Yeah. And you understand what she's saying there is that he would want me to see this and finish it out and, you know, nail this guy. But then the other politician lady goes into saying, you know, it's like, oh, no, it's okay. I think I'm going to be taking over all this. And I'm like, okay, that's just as messed up because now you're just looking for power.
That was the most disconcerting thing to me of this whole scene is that she's taking charge, but she's just as guilty. She acts like she's like, now I'm taking charge.
She's the one who said, okay, screw it. We're just going to set them up like this. It was her idea to sell the kids out like that. It's like, Jesus. So, I mean, that's one thing, like I was saying, they don't excuse what it costs to get here. We're still in the same shitty situation we were. We just don't have the 4, 5, 6 anymore. And, you know, Jack is broken. Gwen and Reese are broken. You know, nobody came out of this without injury. You know, John Frobisher and his whole family are dead. Yeah, and they don't try and say, oh, okay, everything ended well, so it's all okay.
Yeah, man.
That's why this is not for kids.
That's why this is for kids?
Is that why?
Jeez. Oh, jeez. But, yeah, that is the journey that is Children of Earth. I didn't think we'd make it. I do have to say that going through it this time was a lot more fulfilling for me because the first time I watched it, nobody was close to me nobody close to me had seen it or had seen it recently enough to be willing to talk about it. They were, you know, they were just getting the hard case on their scars from it. So they didn't want to talk about it. So I watched this and had to go through it myself and not have any way to talk about it or discuss it. So going through it this way definitely helped. Because it's just brutal trying to go through this by yourself. Thankfully, if you're listening to this, that means that you've kind of been able to get other opinions as well and hopefully shared yours. But yeah, if you know people,
a couple of instances you're sharing with us, yeah.
If you know people that have gone through this and need someone to talk to and you're not willing to do it, steer them this way. Let them listen to this at least. Give them some kind of outlet.
Yeah, hold out of this now.
Yeah, you don't have to do it alone.
Yeah. All right. So let's go ahead and talk about some news and cheer things up here.
We can. This is pretty. As we're recording, this is a milestone week in terms of anniversary rotations here. All kinds of interesting things had happened at intervals around this week, 50 years prior. We have obviously the fact that the shooting on our original, you know, our pilot episode began back on the 19th of September, 50 years back, when An Unearthly Child, or at least the last edition of the script that they worked on, because we've seen some others. The last edition of the script for An Unearthly Child was first started filming. Interesting to note, and I just appended this and unleashed it on YouTube earlier today, was the fact that in keeping with this, the director for the episode previously decided that he was going to, I'm not really sure how it came about, but Waris Hussein's blueprints for the set interior that became our first known vision of the TARDIS interior and console were released so that we could all take a look at all of his sketchwork, which was really, really cool. A little difficult to read through some of the scratch work on here, but they do an interesting job. There's an article, obviously, from the Radio Times that we'll have in the link dump that you can take a look at the photos, and they do an interesting kind of a breakdown of the individual sets as they had it laid out on the BBC studio floor. Just really kind of cool to see how they were using the space and using every freaking inch of the space.
Yeah.
Like you see, you walk about 2 feet off set on stage left and you're at a fire door out to the street. Like they were not working in a vast amount of space here. This is not a Hollywood soundstage where they had acres and acres of room and vaulting ceilings to work in. So it's just really interesting to see how this is like community theater kind of utilizing space here. I was really impressed.
Yeah, it's really cool the way that they were able to cram it all in there and everything. It's just kind of fun to go and look at it. I'm hoping that the team from An Adventure in Space and Time were able to get a hold of this and look at it. If for nothing else, just for sheer nostalgia of, okay, this is what was going through their heads at the time.
So. Yeah. It's just kind of cool. Get a chance to, if you've never watched the original episode, I would definitely recommend taking a look at that first and just kind of get a feel for the way that they, even if you're not really, you don't watch a lot of First Doctor, it is kind of an interesting experience seeing the episodes in that kind of a raw form. But get a feel for the way that they were using their set arrangement, you know, obviously knowing the budgets that they had to work with and knowing their space constraints and so forth. And it did have a kind of a small theater feel to it in the way that they were trying to dress their sets and such. And then take a look at this diagram and see how they had to spin their four cameras around to try and make all the interior shots that they were doing work. And just, this is the kind of thing that I'm hoping that the Adventure in Space and Time is going to help us see that, you know, that peek into the magic and that kind of thing. I love the technical aspects of theater and television and film production and those things. I'm fascinated.
Well, now when
when
you see An Adventure in Space and Time, you'll be able to tell if they used this.
Well, I mean,
you know?
Yeah.
Even if it's never addressed directly, now that we have this.
Mm-hmm. I think if anything, they'll probably have to blow it up a little larger scale so that they have some room to move their film crews through. Because if they're doing like behind the scenes, there was no room to have behind the scenes here. If you put the camera down, you were right up against the scene in your face.
I mean, one of the cool things to point out here, and they mention it in the article, is that they were basically shooting as live. You know, they would shoot on four cameras and take very few breaks. And you got to think, we're 8 weeks out, give or take, from the 50th anniversary. If they started filming, you know, just recently, that's 8 weeks to get this out. That try and do that with a modern episode of Doctor Who, and you might get the title sequence.
Yeah, hey. This is like South Park turnaround time.
Speaking of production. Time for title sequences, Jay.
It's almost like I planned that.
Yeah, nice link.
And again, being pointed out makes it so much better.
Exactly. Well, our little tiny minds had been blown. Thanks to some fan creation.
There was a title sequence, a fan-made title sequence that came out this past week, give or take, for the 12th Doctor, and this is just mind-numbingly awesome. I mean, as soon as I saw this, I was like, oh, please, God, let someone at the BBC grab a hold of this and hire this guy, because this is just amazing.
Mm-hmm. I'm hoping that it was accidentally leaked and this is going to be the real thing, because if that comes on and I don't see that, I'm going to be severely disappointed.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I think that if the one very clear indication that this could not have been intended, because one of the things that they will never do is they will never screw up the talent's name. And Jenna Coleman's name is listed as Jenna Louise Coleman in this little false intro. So it's, you know, if nothing else, then that's a kind of an indication that this was something put together by a fan. But the quality on it, and just some of the choices made in terms of using a lot of the Gallifreyan logos and using the Master's watch and all kinds of just fascinating elements. You could just sit there and take it apart and think, you know, frame by frame, this guy is passionate about wanting to really tap into the fun of the show. You know, all the clockwork and the machinery and the gears spinning and so forth, and the spiral clock faces that you're driving into that have replaced the classic vortex that we had been flying through before. Just awesome. Just really, really, you have to take your hat off to this guy or girl. I don't even know. Have we got a name associated with who did this?
I haven't been able to find anything.
Wait, no, I did. Where's the article?
You did?
You did?
I thought it was in the article that you liked.
It's just it's given as Billy Da Kid. But we don't know. I would think at this point they would have come out and say, you know, because this isn't. I wouldn't worry about threats of copyright infringement or the BBC coming crashing down for something like that, because there's so much fanfic out there. I mean, it's
But I'd worry about a paycheck from the BBC hitting his front door. Because seriously, why is this guy not hired on yet? Yeah. Anyway. But yeah, if you haven't seen it yet, go check it out. It's in the show notes and it's amazing.
It really is.
So.
Yeah. Once we start getting, and I think those are going to be some of the kind of the earlier teasers that we may get as we get closer to the Christmas episode, that will unveil, you know, our new intro, and also potentially any change to, our music as well. You know, keep tweeting Murray Gold and drive him crazy with questions about what you're working on, Murray, and, see if we're going to have yet another, you know, slight adjustment, to the intro, as they had been doing in the last couple of seasons with Matt Smith. So,
So some of the excess material that's coming up, well, I don't want to say excess, but, the circular or not, geez, some of the extra stuff that's coming out, the book that we saw in the Bells of St. John, The Summer Falls by Amelia Williams, is actually going to be released now. And it's going to come with Summer Falls by Amelia Williams, The Angel's Kiss by Melody Malone, and Devil in the Smoke by Mr. Justin Richards.
Which, that's a rather obscure little one. I mean, The Summer Falls, I thought they did a pretty good job of really kind of selling that forward. And even more so, obviously, The Angel's Kiss. The Melody Malone detective story from Angel's Take Manhattan was one
I actually got The Angel's Kiss. And it was not the book that Amy had. This is not the story that goes along with Angels Take Manhattan. This is something completely separate. It's a different case that
it's
Melody
another
worked
Melody
on.
Malone book. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's still really good. It's just it wasn't what I thought I was getting.
But can you get an audiobook read by Alex Kingston?
I don't know.
That they can take five times my money if they could bet. Take my money five
that
times.
That would be awesome. Yes.
But the pulling from the Justin Richards book, you know, The Devil in the Smoke, that was an interesting kind of pull from that episode. I never really would have thought it never would have occurred to me to see someone actually put that to print. But good play on.
So that came from The Snowman, because I actually had to look into that and figure out where they were getting that one from. So if you're sitting there wondering what we're talking about, it was from The Snowman. Right. So but then we've got more Doctor Who books as well. The Ninth Doctor in the Puffin Penguin, whatever it is, series has come out. The Beast of Babylon.
Right, right. So this is our ninth installment now in the ebooks that have been put out for young readers in celebration of the anniversary year here. So we are getting down to some of the final ones here. As far as the I mean, most of the books, Charlie Higson has written a handful of sort of sci-fi or dystopian novels that I would say probably about half his material is really kind of targeted towards towards young audiences. But those ones that he has done have had a lot to do with kind of the zombie approach, which has obviously made him kind of popular at the moment because zombies are cool and everyone knows it. You know, books like more recently things like The Enemy or By Royal Command and those things that kind of have a bit of a I'm not going to call them Born Identity sort of ideas, but it's almost that idea of the the youth spy, youth involvement in cloak and dagger kind of stuff. But there's a paranormal or supernatural element to him as well. So interesting little blend. And I have not gotten a whole lot of details about The Beast of Babylon. It's been reviewed kind of tepidly, but I think some of the things that I had read about it said that he did do a fair job of capturing Eccleston's cooler demeanor. And by cool, I don't mean like, hey, cool. I mean, cool as in chilly
right.
or sort of spiky. Just be prepared. And this is one of the things that a lot of reviewers were commenting on is the fact that despite the fact that this is a ninth book, there's no Rose. So it is a ninth Doctor with no Rose as a companion, which is a little unusual, but take it as it is.
Yeah. So, all right. I think we're okay to start taking bets now. Do we think that Rowling is going to be named for the 10th Doctor or 11th Doctor book?
I'm going with 11th because I think we would have heard about 10th by now, seeing as how we're going to see it in less than a month.
Well, they've been doing very good about keeping the author's name until the 7th of the month that it's released. Right. So we've still got another week or two before we hear who's the 10th Doctor.
I just think because they're really going to try and use as much of the forward momentum that this media juggernaut has right now, that take your two powerhouses. Take your most recent Doctor, who is the young viewer fan favorite to date, you know, the under 20 crowd, and stick that with the most popular author, you know, for that demographic.
That's why I think it's going to be 11.
Okay. Who does that leave for 10th?
Yeah, I was going to say, any guesses on 10? Because I don't know. I mean, Ian Colfer was the only other one that I could have named with some thought. I don't know many, you know, children's authors to put in there.
Unless you had Roald Dahl, Garth Nix, Terry Pratchett, Neil Gaiman. Hello. Could have had a little spare time. I mean, it's just a little ebook. You know, these aren't terribly long. I'm sure he could have cranked one of these out in a weekend with a good pot of coffee. But,
given Gaiman's ties to the show, do you think that it's possible that he might get the 11th Doctor? If it comes to a choice between him and Rowling, which do you think they're going to give? Because Neil Gaiman is tied to it. Yeah, he's written a couple episodes.
I think it would be really interesting to see him do 10.
Yeah, because he's been writing for 11. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it could just be an extended look at one of his scripts or something, maybe, you know, or an idea that he had for a script that got passed
on.
That's
true. That's really true. He could have used a lot of concept work in his early sketchings to flesh out into a short story or a novella or however you want to categorize it.
Right. Well, we've got about 2 weeks to figure out who's going to do 10, and then we should probably have a very good idea on who's going to be 11. But we'll see what happens.
Exactly. But, cool.
So, and then I know we talked about it last week, I think, that the UK is finally going to be getting The Doctors Revisited.
Yep.
That's finally coming to you. They have released a schedule now. It's going to start on October 12th, and it looks like it's going to be one on Saturday, one on Sunday, then the next week, Saturday, Sunday. So October 12th, they're starting with the first Doctor at 2 o'clock. Then the 13th, they're starting with the second Doctor, and so on and so forth, all the way up till the 16th with Matt Smith.
Yes, they're really getting them in rapid succession. So good on you for waiting and being as patient as you've been, because now you get them in a blast. Whereas we've had to sit here and wait month and month and month and month. We're getting up to the good ones now because we just had McGann a little while ago, going into Eccleston right now, which is broadcasting this coming weekend.
Yes.
All right.
So probably after you've heard this episode, probably. But
and obviously, you know, it's always interesting to see what episodes, the exemplification episodes they choose to stick with each Doctor. You know, going on things like, you know, we kind of knew that something like Spearhead from Space was going to go along with Third Doctor because it was a great villain and a great challenge to the doctors from a from an emotional level as well as a as an intelligence level. You know, taking something like Earthshock for Peter Davidson, sure, absolutely, kill that damn companion.
Yeah,
Battlefield for Sylvester McCoy was a great choice. But here we go, going into ninth, and there, what else could you possibly grab other than Bad Wolf?
The only other thing I could think of is the empty child in The Doctor Dances.
True.
But true. I don't know if you're trying to capture who the doctor really is.
I think they're going to go with like Rose. It's supposed to be an intro.
They've already got him posted as the Bad Wolf in the Parting of the Ways, because that's what we're getting here in the States.
Right. Yeah. And some of the reason behind that, Melissa, is because think about when they were doing the classic Doctors and they were taking the serials, you were having typically four 21 or 22 minute serials getting structured together. So you're looking at about, you know, anywhere from 70 to 85 minutes of broadcast time. Then they did, obviously, they get up to McGann last month and they had the movie. So, you know, obviously running time there. So they couldn't go with a single episode. And it'd probably be in their best interest to do one of the pair episodes, not only just because, obviously, for running time for the two of them together, but also just because of the fact that that means, obviously, if it was a dual episode, that it probably was something really meaty that, you know, that they could really put out there as this great dramatic example of that actor's work. So,
yeah.
So to round that out, yes, we've got a Bad Wolf and Parting of the Ways announced for Eccleston for ninth. Next month, as we get David Tennant, we'll get David Tennant's Doctor's Revisited, which should be fascinating interviews all around, I'm sure.
Yeah.
We'll have Stolen Earth and Journey's End, and then...
That's a rough pick.
Yeah.
Honestly, I'm not sure why they went with those, but...
I don't know, actually. We'll have to talk about that one as we start getting through as we draw a little closer or start getting into our rewatches too. But then we're going to wrap it up obviously as we get into where they're going to put this in November to make this work. If the UK is getting it on the 16th of November, typically we here in the States have been getting it on the last weekend of the month. Mm-hmm. So does that mean that the UK is going to get the last Revisited before we do?
I wouldn't be surprised if that's like a simulcast kind of thing. Like they'll release it on the same day for both of us because it would almost be pointless to put this after the 50th special.
Sure. Yep. Yep. Yeah. But that'll finish up with the Impossible Astronaut and Day of the Moon, which I think is an interesting choice for those.
Yeah. I mean, you could have gone with some better ones, or possibly better ones, I don't know, but it's, those aren't bad choices.
I might defend that one. That's just because of my River Song.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So got that on the board. Congratulations.
Yeah. And then and then in the non-news of the week, there's a GQ interview that I found. Apparently this is back from 2011, but apparently GQ had interviewed David Tennant. And I mean, this is just some fascinating stuff that they put in here, just looking at it from his point of view. And a lot of it you've probably heard from different things now, but one of the things I found interesting was the fact that, you know, David Tennant claims that it was him that got them to change the credits to The Doctor instead of Doctor Who. Mm-hmm. He said, I talked to producers. Obviously, I've got enough Asperger's syndrome kicking around that I had to get that particular box ticked. It wasn't contractual. I wasn't going to the wall on it. But I think I'm right in saying that there are certain copies of the DVD box set that have the old version. It's been corrected in the second pressing. And then he quickly says, oh, dear, I sound like such a dweeb now, don't I?
Wait, he said he had Asperger's? That's really, like, disrespectful.
Yeah, but...
Maybe he does.
Maybe he does, and acting helped him overcome
That's it. That's true. I'm being... But wait, speaking of David Tennant in 2011, Keir, you just watched Much Ado About Nothing, too, didn't you?
Yeah, and I'm going to watch it again this weekend, because now I've got my hands on both that 2011 production and Joss Whedon's 2013 production, and I'm going to watch them back-to-back Saturday morning and ignore all of my housework. So it's just fascinating to see Tennant and Tate on stage together in a solid Shakespearean comedy. I mean, Much Ado, obviously, being one of the best ones you can lay your hands on.
Catherine Tate was born to play Beatrice.
Like, God, she is just scathing. It's awesome. It is awesome.
I actually also just watched the Globe on screen, or whatever they were calling it, where Arthur Darvill played Mephistopheles in Faust.
Right.
I definitely recommend people check that out as well.
Yeah, right.
It was really good. It's like a hard part to play, and I think he nailed it. I don't know what the reviews were, but
Faust is a complex piece to begin with on any level.
Have either of you guys seen Broadchurch? It's almost like a cop drama that they're doing on BBC and here on BBC America. It's David Tennant and Arthur Darvill are both in it, and I've only seen like half of an episode. I've got it set to record. I just haven't been able to catch up on it yet. Yeah. It's actually really good. It's not at all Doctor Who, but I love both of these actors in and of themselves, not just the roles they played, and they're fantastic in this.
Yeah, we've got some friends and listeners who have been watching it as well, and I've been hearing some good things. It's just a matter of I put it on the queue with everything else.
Yeah, exactly.
No, I do actually intend to watch that.
Yeah. I was just trying to find a good starting spot, and every time I saw a commercial come on, I'm like, screw it, I'm just going to record it and watch from here. I'll catch up later. which kills the completionist in me, but, you know, it happens.
True.
So, all right. Well, that about does it for what we've got this week. Next week, we will be coming back starting our commentary series for Series 7B.
Yeah.
We will be doing the Bells of St. John next week. So getting started on this and counting down quickly to the 50th anniversary special.
Yes, everyone should be very happy because we're moving on. The days are growing short.
Yeah, we were worried months ago. I was like, what the hell are we going to talk about for the next couple of months? This wait is going to be absolutely painful, but...
Yeah, now we're like, well, we'll have to push that one till after the 50th because we've got too much to talk about now.
So news is coming fast and furious.
Yes. So, yeah, definitely get your thoughts in on for the Bells of St. John. You know, go back, rewatch it, and let us know what you think about it after all this time. Does it hold up? Does it not? Does it stay in the same for you? So you can write us at Gallifrey Radio on Twitter. You can find us on Facebook, iTunes comments, email us at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com. Go to gallifreypublicradio.com and leave comments on the post there. We also now have a voicemail. You can call and leave us voice messages that we can play on the show for you. That number is 210-802-1477. That's 210-802-1GPR.
Whoa. So, I was about to say, give me about a day so I can figure out what that spells out in the touchpad, but that's awesome.
Yeah. So, get us your voicemails or your text messages or however you want to do it. Just get us your thoughts on that.
Do it.
All right. Well, this has been episode 54 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, this is Jay saying, thank God it's over. I don't have to watch this again.
And this is Melissa saying the same thing. I never thought I would be so happy to see Bells of St. John.
Wow.
Oh, we know how next week's going to go.
Oh, and this is Kier saying, I regret nothing.
We'll see you guys next week.
Absolutely.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. Have something to say, something we got wrong, or something you just need to weigh in on? Send us an email at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com or leave us a voicemail at 210-802-1477. That's 210-802-1GPR. You can also find us on Twitter at Gallifrey Radio, on Stitcher Smart Radio, facebook.com/Gallifrey Public Radio, or on iTunes. You can also head over to our homepage at gallifreypublicradio.com where you can leave comments on each episode and get into discussions on the topics we bring up. You can also keep up to date on all the latest news and what's going on in the community. Music by Beyond the Epilogue and Retcon Addict.
Gallifrey Public Radio is copyright 2013.